Well, good afternoon, everybody. It looks like our usual intro did not kick off, so sorry about the quiet there, but welcome, everybody, to another edition of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with us live, if you'd like, you can go to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. And if you'd want to join us already, we see Paul and NEC are already there. If you want to join in with them, if you have some observations that you wanted to share during the course of the show, or there was simply a question you would hope that we would ask our guest during the course of the next hour, that's a great place to put it. We'll do our best to try to roll that into the conversation as we go forward. And as always, if you haven't already, I'd ask you to go ahead and go over to iTunes, or Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't subscribed to Midrats, you can go ahead and do that. And that way, this show or other shows will always be available for you if you want to see what's going on in this world. And on today's show, when you look at for generations, something we were talking about a little bit in the pre-show, is from our very senior leadership down to those that are leading in the field, we really haven't in the U.S. and amongst our allies had an opportunity to be all that concerned about, for lack of a phrase, receiving traditional fires from opponents. Yes, we've had IEDs, terrorist attacks, the odd 107-millimeter rocket lobbed in from the hillside, but we haven't really been on the receiving end of traditionally when you're at a peer or near peer operation we've had to worry about. And as such, our desire to have all domain awareness, whether you're looking at tactical level leadership or all the way up to the four-star headquarters, people like to have their full video, people like to have that 1,000-yard screwdriver nearby. And for that to take place, it takes a big staff, it takes a lot of electrons and a lot of habits to make it happen. And what we're going to do today is we're going to look at some of the lessons in this area that we've seen over the course of the last 15 months during the Russo-Ukrainian war. And our guest today for the full hour to do that is Lieutenant Colonel Matt Errol, U.S. Army. He is the Commandant of the U.S. Army Joint Support Team at Hurlburt Field in Florida. And if you go to the show page, you will see a link to the article that we're going to be using as kind of the touch base, the starting place for our conversation over at Military Review titled The Graveyard of Command Post that he co-authored with two other individuals. And Matt, welcome to Midrats.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sal. Appreciate it and appreciate the opportunity to kind of talk about the article, talk about command and control in this large-scale combat operations environment and in multi-domain operations as we understand them in the Army. Kind of wanted to start off, give your listeners a little more understanding about my organization, kind of what it does, and why this article really is kind of significant coming out of us. So the Army Joint Support Team, we're a directorate under the Army's Mission Command Center of Excellence, which is one of several centers of excellence underneath the Army's Combined Arms Center. So if you think about major Army commands, you have TRADOC, which is kind of our institutional arm, and then underneath that you have CAC, which you know is responsible for integrating doctrine, the entire .MILPF in support of our operations. Mission Command Center of Excellence is really responsible for C2, and my organization is responsible for integrating Army C2 into Joint C2 specifically for air operations. And so if you look at kind of the bylines of my colleagues, General Slider and General Beagle, you kind of understand this is really the leadership of the Army on C2 and on combined arms operations, which are kind of fostering this discussion about command posts. Because in the Army, we are seeing that, you know, as we transition from counterinsurgency into the current operating environment, you know, we've gone through this transition of our operating concepts from unified land operations to multi-domain operations. And there were a lot of good reasons for why we did that. A lot of it had to do with threat and environment, the recognition and really utilization of all of those domains, plus, you know, the dimensions of human information and the material and physical dimension, And so what we're trying to really articulate with this article is that we have a real problem in our C2s, in our command post right now, between survivability and effectiveness. We did a really good job under COIN of pushing power down to the lowest possible level where it could interact with the civil populace. And obviously, you know, we can argue about how effective we were with overarching COIN as a methodology. But we did a very good job of kind of pushing that type of C2 capability down to the lowest possible level to interact with the populace. But the outcome of that has been that our command posts and our C2 writ large are out of balance right now for the operating environment in which we find ourselves. So as we looked at this article, General Slider really being the individual responsible for C2 in the Army had asked me, had brought me on board and said, hey, Matt, I need you to help craft a narrative that highlights this problem, frame that problem, and kind of put it into the tenets and dimensions of the Army's operating concept, and let's help propose a solution that can kind of move the discussion forward. So, you know, it isn't doctrine, it is an article, but what we try to do is draw out those ideas and get folks in the Army and elsewhere to think in terms of what it takes to be successful from a command post and from a C2 perspective in multi-domain operations.
Yeah, but before we go any further, we should point out that the opinions expressed by Matt in this show and in the article by he and his co-authors are their opinions and don't necessarily reflect the doctrine the command to which they belong. So he's a free agent for this show purpose. One of the things I think we have to start with is that the problem identified with the continuing large growth of command posts, and I think you've described it pretty well in the article, but could you kind of set forth what prompts the concerns for the U.S. Army and probably for our other services about this increasing number of people who have their fingers in the pie and all the electronic stuff they bring with that, and why it's a problem, and what we're trying to avoid. We certainly don't. The lessons learned from Ukraine include not having your senior leadership decapitated. So, kind of run with it.
Yeah. So honestly, you know, what we try to do in the article is kind of trace the evolution of command posts. You know, going back to when it was just the commander in the saddle. Obviously, you know, command posts serve the commander in all respects, right? So it they're functionally as a tool to enable his decision-making process. And so as we've gone over time, over history, you know, we've gone from, you know, very small set-piece battles to much larger conflicts, world wars, all those types of things. And along with that, we have developed better and more ways of kind of reining in the chaos of warfare, right? And so we've done that through the proliferation of staffs. We've done that through automation. You can kind of trace the technical advancement and the evolution of command posts, you know, going back 300-400 years to kind of get us to where we're at today, right? And so you get through, you know, the 20th century, and you're really getting into some areas where we've gone from basically, you know, the maritime domain, the land domain. Well, then you started having the air domain. Okay, so now we got to think in three dimensions. Now you start talking about cyber domain and space domain and all this additional stuff that the commander has to be able to visualize, articulate, be able to direct his forces. And with all of that, because comes a bill, right? He has to, regardless of circumstances, maintain decision dominance throughout, right? And so, you know, as we discussed in the article, that led to the growth of staffs, subject matter experts being close at hand, because that proximity will always matter. But then on top of that, you're talking about all the additional automation, all of the IT infrastructure, all of that can really put all of those different multi-domain aspects in the hands of the commander so he can make the best possible decision in the shortest possible time and maintain that decision dominance to achieve victory on the battlefield. And over time, that has, you know, so technology has contributed to his survivability in some respects, and it has hindered his survivability in some respects. And we've gone through this period of about 20 years during the counterinsurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you really didn't have that pressure, that external threat environment pressure to keep those command posts small, right, to keep those command posts survivable, because they were able to deal from essentially a place of sanctuary, whether it was behind, you know, the T-wall barriers of, you know, major headquarters in Iraq or Afghanistan, all those type of things. There wasn't necessarily an existential threat to command posts at echelons above, you know, the brigade level. But that environment has now changed. And both the war in Nagorno-Karabakh and the war, obviously, in Ukraine has highlighted that. And so as we, you know, wrote the article, we tried to pull on that sense of urgency and say, hey, look, here is, for the first time in a long time, real empirical evidence that our command posts are not fit for purpose.
You know, one thing about any institution that has habits, tradition, or just a lot of bureaucratic inertia is it can be immune to, depending upon what area you're in, inconvenient facts or inconvenient history or incomplete understanding of the lessons that are they're being tapped on the shoulder to look at. You mentioned the Nagorno-Karabakh battle, and, you know, going, one of the favorite examples I like to use, because everybody uses it, is, you know, all the things that were new during World War II were actually demonstrated and hinted at during the Spanish Civil War. And the Russians obviously knew what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh, but when they invaded, amongst a lot of things that they perhaps didn't fully hoist on board there, also in Syria, you know, the Russians aren't like a lot of militaries in the world that haven't had combat operations recently. They have. But they also have that tradition and that mindset and that bureaucratic and leadership culture that manifests itself in such a way that they learn the hard way themselves with the invasion of Ukraine. And you start off your article, I thought, with a really eye-opening demonstration of this that brought together four or five different threads. For the listeners, describe a bit what happened at Shornobakva, I think I pronounced it right. Yeah, probably not. Not just the lessons that came from that, but how that one event had ripple effects throughout that theater.
Yeah, absolutely. So the village of Chernobayevka is in the Kherson Oblast on the banks of the Dnieper River. So if you recall, like, the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, it was a multi-axis invasion with the Kherson Avenue being kind of one of the southern approaches. They were able to – the Russians were able to advance across the Dnieper River and kind of establish a little bit of a foothold in Kherson, in Chernobayevka. But what they were opposed by, obviously, was a very determined Ukrainian army, and that Ukrainian army was reinforced by additional support from the U.S. and its allies to provide a level of ISR coupled with, you know, loitering munitions, drone capabilities, all of this additional kit, despite the fact that they didn't have at that point really a particularly strong air arm, but they had the intelligence to be able to deliver effects in a very systematic manner against those centers of gravity that the Russians needed to be able to consolidate their gains and push that initial lodgment outwards from Kherson. They were never able to really do that on the western side of the Dnieper River because they were never able to get the command and control straight. So the Russians, when they were having challenges at Chernobayevka, they do what Russians sometimes do when they don't have the same plan of mission command C2 philosophy that the West does. They put leadership down at the point of the problem, right? So now you suddenly started seeing generals on the battlefield. You started seeing a lot of senior leaders kind of coordinating their operations in forward command posts. And some of that obviously is a result of, you know, kind of the way that they conduct operations. But the problem with a lot of that is that all of those command posts were very visible because of the ISR support that the Ukrainians were getting from the U.S., from the NATO allies. And they were able to very quickly reduce those command posts, right? Delivering fires and effects, sometimes through, you know, UAVs, sometimes through coordinated fires from mass artillery battalions. But it created a very lethal, very hyperactive environment, which was very difficult for the Russians to kind of deal with. So they were never able to kind of develop the type of momentum that would be necessary to kind of push forward from that. And so the Russians, when they would lose a command post, would, you know, follow up failure with more failure. So they would compound their efforts. And really what you saw in Chernobyl was a series of command posts getting struck at all echelons, you know, from the senior levels where you were having lieutenant generals getting hit, you know, down to, you know, the regimental levels within the divisions down there. So there was, once you took away that C2 structure, it was very difficult for the Russians to coordinate any sort of large-scale combat operations which would have had any success with the Ukraine. So you saw that. And Chernobyl is obviously a very unique case study because it happened to so many command posts in such close proximity. But you've seen that reflected throughout the rest of the Ukraine as well. And then in addition to that, you know, you continue to see that play out. You may not necessarily be seeing all of the generals getting hit the way we did in the first 3 or 4 months because, you know, the Russians, our adversaries, they learn lessons too. But this limited ability for them to conduct command and control is a result of the highly lethal, hyperactive environment that they're finding themselves in and the ability to leverage and outsource ISR effectively and UAS capability to make sure that there really is no sanctuary on the battlefield anymore.
Yeah, one of the stunning things about your article were the images from Fort Irwin of the electronic signature of the command post undergoing training there, and those of us who have been around a while, when we used to do transits in the Navy across the Pacific and other places, and we would go totally under emissions control, we'd shut everything down and try and reduce our emissions signature. Now, we could communicate in a lot of other ways, but if the Army is going to try and focus on reducing these signatures so that you guys don't have these big footprints, and I assume try and be able to hide in the ordinary clutter of the battle and the other units out there, if you could say so without revealing any great state secrets, what kind of things are you looking at to reduce the signature of these of the command posts that we will have?
Well, I think the first step is just having awareness, right, of what that signature actually looks like. So, you know, everything that you see there in terms of the electromagnetic signature of our command post, we weren't really necessarily looking at that, you know, 5-10 years ago, right? We were, you know, and in many cases, 5-10 years ago, we would have brigades go out to the National Training Center because that's what the National Training Center is really good at training is our brigade level formations. But they would go out there and, you know, they may not even put up camouflage nets, right? And so there's the Army in general has gone through this kind of sea change in terms of understanding, okay, this is a highly lethal environment that we're now going to be having to face. And we need to look at all of our signatures and how do we go about, you know, masking those, right? Whether it's distribution or, you know, additional camouflage, you know, we've always kind of had camouflage netting, but we're now paying a lot closer attention to what our electrical signature is looking like, you know, what our noise and visual signatures are looking like. You know, those things are important, and we also have to think about it in terms of not just what is the footprint of the command post for the future going to look like, but what are those other tells that are going to lead people to where our critical command post infrastructure is, whether it's logistics, whether it's, you know, additional support, all of those signatures that we have, the forest worth of antennas, you know, those are keys that and indicators that, that the adversary can clue in on to enable a strike against us. So the things that I would expect to see, and I don't know where we're at in terms of the development of the pipeline is first of all, our command posts have to get more mobile, right? We went through this period where we were using these huge drash tents. We used to call them Taj Mahals, whatnot. And you would coagulate your entire division or core staff inside these things. And it just made for the hugest, most comfortable, but juicy target ever. So we're going to have to, you know, scale down the size of our command posts. And we're going to have to make those things more mobile. Because if you've ever put up like a drash in the desert, you know it probably takes you about 48 hours to get in position. You know, I'm using round numbers, but the challenge is obviously, you know, one, those things aren't mobile at all, right? And then the second piece is, you know, once they're in position, they offer no protection whatsoever, right? So, you know, 155 fragmentation will go right through, you know, anything that's out there in that current setup. So we've got to figure out how do we harden these things? How do we make them more mobile? How do we reduce that signature in terms of electromagnetic emissions, in terms of the noise emissions, light emissions? And now as they're looking at, you know, even quantum capabilities, like being able to trace the movements of organizations and movements of vehicles based at the atomic level, right? That's kind of what we're looking at with the quantum signatures. We're going to have to figure out how do we either mask those signatures so that, you know, our adversaries can't see them, or distribute them to the point where they just kind of blend into the normal fabric of what else is out there in terms of battlefield clutter.
One of the things that kept hitting me as I read the article is, yes, it's very Army-focused, as one would expect, but the lessons and the concepts, every maritime and air commander needs to be thinking along the same lines. Because, you know, we talk about precision fires and, you know, a lot of examples that we see from the Russia-Ukrainian war. When you back up and you look at other potential theaters, especially those in the Pacific west of the international dateline, you have adversaries with precision fires that go through not just the short range, but intermediate and medium range ballistic missile range that brings a threat envelope. And I don't have to tell you this, but, you know, one of the things you always say, you know, don't put your airfields under your enemy's artillery. It's the same idea. If they can reach you and they can find you, they can. I mean, it's a balance. It's one of the things we've talked about in other contexts here is the eternal battle between efficiency and effectiveness. And I think you also outlined in the article well that as we look at this challenge, there are some things, you know, you just can't get rid of, but you've got to find the right balance between effective and survivable. And there is, on the Navy side of the house, I know it is a joint project, there's this desire to have complete multi-domain awareness, basically for the people up high. But to do that, you have to have reach back. There's a lot of
right.
electronics, a lot of support to do that. And so the commander's going to have a need for, and I'm going to quote a little bit from your article, quote, "A commander's need for control and knowledge across all these areas created demand for human and technical decision support tools," end quote. And then a little bit later on, it says, quote, "To increase survivability, commanders sought to protect their command posts by reducing their size, hardening them, splitting them up, camouflaging them, increasing their mobility, and actively defending them against all manner of threats, including air, cyber, and electronic attack," end of quote. Now, to do that, while also you have this institutional desire that people have been, back when I was a sixth guy in the late 90s, it was even there, that we want to have this all domain. Well, you can't have both, so you have to have a way to get that compromise there. And you use a phrase that's been used maybe a little bit too much, mostly at the unit tactical level mission command. If you want to upscale that a bit to the in-theater operational or the operational level mission command, is it going to require a rethink or a change of expectations in order to do kind of what you outlined to command post, because you still have to have that function, but to make it such that it can survive more than D plus one.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. You know, we look at in the Army, because of the complexity and the friction inherent in the land domain, you know, mission commands, you know, and the article just, you know, lays out the Army's definition for mission command. But it really provides us with the ability to kind of make decisions closer to the point of need, right? We kind of push authority down into a decentralized approach to executing operations. And we do that out of necessity because, you know, historically speaking, you know, we can't be assured that our commanders will have the ability to understand everything that's going down at the lowest level. And so we have, over the course of the last, you know, 20 years, we got into the situation where commanders suddenly were able to see kind of what's going down at the tactical level. And so we acknowledge that mission command is an approach to command and control that we're going to have to continue to utilize in the land domain. But we also recognize that the air component is adopting mission command as well. So if you go back and you look at Air Force Doctrinal Publication 1, which came out, I believe it was their last adjustment to that, which I believe was in 2021, they introduced mission command kind of in the place where they used to have centralized control, decentralized execution, which was their approach to air operations and command and control. They introduced that because they could no longer be assured that the Air Operations Center, which were those central nodes for the execution of the air tasking order, the ACO, the SPINs, all those pieces that kind of allow them to conduct centralized control, were going to be survivable in an environment such as we're facing right now, where you do have things like long-range hypersonic weapons, which can basically reach any AOC, you know, within a given theater. Right, you're going to have adversaries that have capabilities that are going to be very difficult to defeat, and so you have to assume that there's going to be some attrition in terms of the command and control, and so that's kind of the challenge that we face when we're looking at command post survivability. Is it's not just, you know, how do you mask, but how do you maintain the same level of effectiveness in an environment where you're having to do the trade-off between survivability and effectiveness. We propose in the article a way to kind of break that paradigm. And from our standpoint, or at least from the author's standpoint, the way to do that really kind of puts a greater focus and priority on the information dimension, which I fully acknowledge is hard sometimes for the maritime component to kind of adopt because of the challenge of being at sea and not necessarily having, you know, land-based servers and all this other kind of additional infrastructure that the air component and the land component have, you know, kind of inherent in how we conduct operations. It's very much harder, in my understanding, for the maritime component to do that while at sea. But that said, you know, we look at that as kind of the way in which we kind of break out of that survivability effectiveness paradigm and kind of, you know, get us to the point where we can conduct distributed operations, where command posts at different echelons can truly be fungible, where we can kind of allow a brigade commander to operate out of a division commander's, allow a corps commander to operate out of the division commander's CP or a division commander to operate out of the brigade commander's CP. Those ideas, if you don't have the infrastructure and the IT and the information capability to support that, you're really locked into kind of the paradigm that we've always historically found ourselves in. And so that's a bit of a challenge. I recognize that a lot of the stuff we talked about in the article are kind of, you know, people be, well, that's, you know, that's infeasible. The technology's not there. It is and it's not, right? So, you know, we talk about virtual reality. We talk about augmented reality and the role that's going to play in the future in terms of command and control. But it really comes down to, like, How do we maintain a level of effectiveness necessary to sustain decision dominance while not, like, falling into the survivability trap? So that's kind of, as we see it, the challenger. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
It answers a lot of questions. One of the questions I have, you know, you talked about it just now, and you talked about it in the article, that we had such great communication structures, which is why we built these massive command posts and other devices during the Vietnam War, we had the President of the United States choosing targets. I mean, how do we get in a mission command environment, which I understand is driven, should be driven, and you correct me if I'm wrong, by the commander's intent, right. how do we get the senior people to back off a little bit and not micromanage and let the people in the field do their job? And if the commander's intent is clear, it shouldn't matter. I hate to say this, it shouldn't matter if the echelon above the gets wiped out. We still know what we're supposed to be doing. Am I off base here?
No, I think you're right on point, and I think that same challenge is felt by all the services equally, right? So, you know, I think it comes back to commanders need to kind of understand what their role is within the capabilities and limitations that are made available to them. There are certain things that you're going to want the President of the United States, you know, making a decision on what targets are going to, you know, we're going to strike as a country, right? In terms of capabilities that have the ability to escalate warfare in directions that nationally we don't necessarily want to go. Those are decisions that, you know, he should probably control at his level. And so what you kind of get to is a bit of a sliding scale of mission command where you say, okay, yes, we know you have all of these different capabilities at your level. You know, we're going to give you access to be able to utilize, you know, these different multidimensional capabilities, but only in certain contexts, right? So if you look at, you know, some of the capabilities that are coming on board for the Army right now, you have the Multi-Domain Task Force and its Multi-Domain Effects Battalion, which has, like, access to cyber and space and some of these different things. Without the proper guardrails, without, you know, from a fire supporter's perspective, the proper fire support coordination measures, you know, maneuver coordination measures or whatever multi-domain effects coordination measures associated with those particular assets, you know, you can get out of your ahead of your skis relatively quickly. And so even within mission command, it's not a free-for-all. You know, it is bounded by the commander's intent, and that commander's intent is reflected in the various control measures that ensure that people do stay within their lane. But I do acknowledge that, you know, sometimes the commanders don't understand their role in some of those situations and find themselves, you know, getting fixated. You know, we used to call it during the Iraq War, we used to call it predator porn. They get fixated on the TV show that's on their you know, command post display showing a predator about ready to strike a vehicle or something like that, and not focused on the things that as a commander they should really be focused on, which is, you know, maybe operational level things, high tactical level things, those kind of things that they should really understand. I like to think that will kind of take care of itself as the complexities of dealing with large-scale operations overwhelm a commander's ability to do that kind of micromanagement. I like to think that's going to happen. I'm not entirely confident that it's. I think that's going to be person-specific, and you're going to have those commanders that do it really well, and you're going to have those commanders that are hopefully going to find themselves out of a job for doing it poorly.
And back when I was a NATO guy doing an Army guy's job, you know, we would do exercises in these late Cold War bunkers way underground where you literally are designed that, oh, yeah, we could have a Hiroshima-sized nuke click off about 100 meters from the entrance and we'll be okay. I mean, they're pretty well designed. And then you go to Kabul and you look at the watch floor and you go, okay, one of those dumb 107-millimeter rockets gets lucky, kind of like the Iraqis got lucky with the Scud at the end of the Gulf War, and this place disappears. What's plan B? And everybody
right.
would just look
yeah.
at each other. We go, we have no plan B. I was like, well, that's interesting. I'm sure somebody
yeah.
did somewhere, but nobody on the watch floor actually did. And kind of the question I had is the Russians have gone through in Ukraine multiple cycles of, you know, attention on deck, here's the general, brief him, poof, he and his staff are gone.
Right.
what have we seen from the Russians as with each iteration as a learning institution, a learning army? I assume because they thought this was going to be one of those 72-hour wars that they were probably caught flat-footed when they got punched in the face a few times at the senior leadership level. But what have we seen, how they've adjusted their approach to command in the field?
Well, I think what we've seen is you're not seeing the massive conferences of senior Russian leaders getting together the way they had been in the early months of this thing. They've learned some lessons too, clearly. But I think, you know, that has come at a pretty steep cost for them. They've lost some from some what I think many people would consider a kind of first-line leadership in the course of that happening. And they've had some significant attrition in what we would consider first-line units, right? So, you know, just off, you know, top of mind, the First Guards Tank Army was very highly regarded in the West prior to the war, and that has been, you know, essentially made combat ineffective in the first year of this war. So, you know, if you can really start taking off, you know, key pieces, centers of gravity, you know, taking those pieces off the table has an effect. Part of the reason why we're in this level of attrition warfare is that both sides are exhausted at this point, right? And we're not necessarily maybe able to, you know, provide our allies with the stuff that they need quickly enough in order to be able to tip the scales and kind of go back over to the offense. We anticipate that that's going to happen later on this spring, and we should see a decent counteroffensive coming out of the Ukrainians here, you know, really any time now. But the challenge obviously is, you know, with a country like Russia, with a country like China, they're pretty deep, right? They have a deep bench, right? And it's one where we're going to have to be able to continue to go back and pound them, right, until we can kind of get to them to the point where you know, they don't have anything more, can't contribute anything more to the fight. But that truly is an attrition style of warfare, and it's not, you know, it's not something we want to get ourselves, you know, involved in if we can possibly help it. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, that's kind of my take on it. Is that's where we're at right now. The Russians are improving, but you know, kind of they paid a price for some poor decisions up front. And you know, I alluded to this in the article as well. You know, as the Americans and as the West, in the mid-2000s, kind of pushed all their combat capability down to the brigade level to conduct expeditionary operations, you know, in the Middle East and Afghanistan and elsewhere. The Russians did the same thing, only instead of their, you know, expeditionary operations being to, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, well, they were to Syria or they were to Georgia or they were to these other places, Libya, so forth. Right. What that did was it pushed capability away from those formations at the division and corps level and the command post at the division and corps level that would be necessary for conducting and coordinating large scale combat operations. So that was kind of, you know, where they took it in the teeth, you know, going directly into the Ukraine with a command post and a C2 structure that was not fit for large scale combat operations. So they're redesigning as they go. And I think we'll see going forward what the results of that are going to be.
I love the term predator porn. I remember during the Kosovo adventure, that was also a factor then, and I think we called it pretty much the same thing. But it's, you know, because the big boss can see what's going on the ground, he wants to direct where things go. And I want to get into that. You talked about data-driven the process and how we need to move away from the current structure into cloud and AI and all kinds of stuff. Can you kind of expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I don't want to say like, well, the Army's never, or the military doesn't use data, but, you know, we do use data. We use it all the time. We're just not very efficient at using it, I guess is what I'm saying. So, you know, right now, you know, with their server stacks and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of infrastructure associated with getting access to that data. And, you know, there is the potential that, you know, data that we need to make decisions, whether it's data for petting targets or whether it's data that we need for other types of decisions, we just don't have a system set up where we can easily access that data when we need to, you know, in order to be able to make those decisions in a timely enough manner. So utilizing things like the Combat Cloud, you know, as an example, utilizing different techniques that we bring in from, you know, the civilian community, we have to be a little bit careful with that because, you know, business, they use different techniques that may not hold up necessarily under the rigors of combat and some of the types of things that the military has to do. So we do have to be a little bit careful with that. But you know, the ability to access that and make sure that when our units are isolated, their information is isolated, because that's going to happen in an environment going forward. You're going to have units that are isolated and they're going to have to operate isolated. So you're going to have to be able to provide, they're not only going to have to be able to endure to sustain themselves under that type of pressure, but they're also going to have to continue to get the information that they need to be able to continue to survive and make good decisions and operate effectively when they're no longer in physical contact with friendly forces. So movement to the cloud, greater reliance on satellite communications, other types of communications. The ones that are going to bear the burden for all of this going forward is the IT community, is the communications community. They're going to ones that are kind of, as they always have in the past, kind of take it on the chin in order to kind of move the command and control, you know, team forward. So, yes, greater emphasis on the information dimension in order to be able to accommodate that. But in the end, it's going to be better off for everybody.
Yeah, the old cliche is, you know, the four shops, the logistics always get a veto. I think we need to modify that in this century, that the six shops get a veto too. It's all you got to do is come up with this great plan, and then you ask for the input from the six shop, and they go, we have no points of presence, we can't do that. There's no satellite access, and you go, okay, well let's talk about that for a bit.
Right.
It's interesting
Absolutely.
How that's developed.
And
you know, I don't want to. Oh, go ahead.
No, what I was going to say is, you know, what does that require, right? We've spent, you know, years and years and years spending time with our commanders, talking to them about the importance of logistics and how those are a constraint on their operations. I would argue that we have not done due diligence with our commanders and inflicting on them the importance of their data, the importance of communications. You know, F6 is, you know, I've had commanders who've been, you know, who've talked about, you know, I don't know what the F6 does or what the combo guys do, but I know it when it's not there. You know, it's kind of like oxygen, right? but it's one of those where, like, we're going to have to really inform and educate our commanders on how they utilize data, what that data is for, what are the considerations they need to, you know, develop in terms of how they plan operations, because ultimately I think their operations are going to depend upon how they use that in making decisions.
Yeah, that bandwidth thirst can get a little bit out of control depending upon where you are. And I don't want to scare people by using the D word, doctrine, but doctrine's important. Words mean things. You know, people joke that, well, nobody reads that crap. Well, people that matter and who write checks, and they do read that stuff because they have to justify what they're trying to do. And words mean things too, you know, how you define them, how you look at them. And especially in a combined operations, you know, get outside the joint world, we very rarely do things by ourselves. You know, one of the funny exchanges was, usually it was a Dutch or a German. Somebody would quote Clausewitz about something, and then you have a 20-minute discussion about how terrible the English translations of the original German were.
That's a dangerous game.
it's a very dangerous game with those guys. But you mentioned that the Army, their capstone document, the Field Manual 3-0 Operations, was updated back in October. And you took some time, not by accident, to find these four words when they're talking about what the direction the command post need to go, because I get the impression by looking at that, the Army is going, hey, this is an issue. We need to resolve it. And they put four words there: agility, convergence, endurance, and depth. And I think that applies to more than just, you know, the Army. That is a joint concern about our major C2 nodes. You know, talk a little bit inside 3TAC-0, how they defined at the core that agility, convergence, endurance, and depth.
So, and I try to lay it out in the article, the Army's definition of each of those. But what's interesting is that those tenets of what we're characterizing as multi-domain operations in the current 3.0, if you look at earlier iterations of FM 3.0, our capstone operating doctrine, so you'll see those terms applied, right? Depth is not a new term for the Army. Endurance is not a new term. Agility is not a new term. But in multi-domain operations, we think of those kind of in a different context, right? So, you know, agility obviously denotes speed, but also nimbleness, the ability to change quickly. When we think about that in terms of command and control, you know, and what the point that I try to make in the article is that it's not just the ability to, you know, displace, in place, all those different types of things, move a command post quickly. We need to think about it in terms of the ability for command post to take on different roles, whether that's a brigade doing a division's job or a division doing a corps job or maybe, you know, up to the Army Service Component Command or the R4 level, you know, doing different roles based upon, you know, what we need that command post to do based upon maybe something has happened on the battlefield or something that we need to think about agility in different terms than perhaps we have in the past. The newest tenet that they've come up with for multi-domain operations for the current FM 3.0, that convergence, you know, really that kind of builds upon the old principle of mass, right? Where in the past we used mass to overwhelm an adversary's capabilities. And understanding convergence, we're talking about, you know, an outcome created by the concerted deployment of capabilities from multi-domains and echelons against combinations of decisive deployments in any domain to create effects against the system. So it's still very closely aligned to effects the way that mass was. However, what it tries to convey here is the multi-domain aspect of it. We're now attacking not just like singular centers of gravity, but multiple centers of gravity with employing assets from different domains at different echelons. So it really isn't, you know, mass as, you know, new wine in an old bottle, right? What we're really saying here is we're going to take a systems approach to warfare, and convergence is going to be the tool that we go to get after that. And so kind of to your point earlier, we were talking about, you know, reliance on allies. You know, we fully intend to use allied capabilities to help enable that convergence. So I am, as a fire supporter, I'm completely, you know, agnostic as to whether, you know, that 155 round comes out of a U.S. 777 howitzer or whether it comes out of a Caesar, a French Caesar gun or whatever, right? So, you know, we need to kind of look at convergence as, you know, the totality of the joint force plus, you know, our allies' contributions to get after not just attacking one point of presence on the battlefield, but all points of presence relative to the particular system that we're trying to take out, whether that's an indirect, whether that's an integrated fire control or an integrated fire system, whether that's an IADS threat, whether that's something else, right? So that's kind of what we're talking about when we discuss, you know, convergence. When we think about endurance, you know, that has some, you know, historical connotations in terms of our ability to, you know, persevere over time. So that's kind of your survivability aspect, but it's also your ability to sustain the fight going forward. So, you know, and that's, you know, through time and the depths of an operational environment, endurance is something that, you know, historically we've kind of think, well, that's kind of a sustainment. You're going to be limited in terms of your operational, in terms of your ability to conduct operations by your logistics. You may get to a point where you have to culminate and then transition. You know, we're trying to kind of get out of just a sustainment viewpoint of endurance and kind of expand that into not just, you know, demonstrating resilience and persistence, but also, you know, be able to do that through time as well. So that's kind of what we're talking about with that. And then we thinking about depth, you know, really we kind of view depth as our ability to extend our operation through time and space and through cognitive purpose. You know, we used to think of depth purely in terms of how do we extend the battlefield, right? You know, in terms of air-land battle, we're going to strike second echelon forces or we're going to, you know, it had a very geographic approach to things. But now, you know, we're viewing depth because depth used to be attended under those operating concepts as well. Now we're viewing depth as not just, you know, how are we able to do that in space, but, you know, through, you know, cyber means or into like space, or across time, you know, how do we create some sort of advantage or exploit, you know, our opportunities, and kind of allow us to make decisions faster within our command posts so that we actually buy the commander some time to make decisions, right? And so we're able to kind of take apart pieces of our adversary's systems in detail versus kind of dealing with everything right up front. So that's kind of what we're talking about when we discuss those four tenets. And if your listeners really want to get a good feel for multi-domain operations, one of the main videos that I'd encourage everybody to go out on the internet and look for, there's a YouTube video out there presented by Rich Creed, the director of the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at Fort Leavenworth, which really does a good job of laying out the differences between multi-domain operations and the tenets that I just described and kind of what came before that and why those changes exist, because they all exist for really good reasons based upon the threat in the environment.
Everybody's kind of gotten on the bandwagon the last few years looking at the challenge of the Western Pacific. And you know, geography doesn't change, and so the same challenge our grandfathers and great-grandfathers had with the battle west of the international date line east of India are going to repeat themselves again. And that's a terrain, whether you're at sea or ashore or in the air, that's very different than the Russo-Ukrainian environment. It's more littoral, much smaller, little tiny islands here and there. The alliance networks are a little bit different. And I was interested on your perspective, the Marine Corps, with their expeditionary mindset that General Berger, the Commandant's been pushing recently, involves having, you know, various units located on a vastly dispersed type of environment and different islands to present different challenges. And I think one of the larger challenges there is just being able to do your basic communications, much less any type of command post operation that especially an Army is looking at. And I know the Army is looking hard at how they're going to be able to support any potential contingencies out in the Pacific. If we look too much at the Russo-Ukrainian challenge, are there some issues that you see that perhaps we would encounter trying to maintain effective command and control throughout the Pacific theater that maybe are not directly connected to things that we're looking at trying to learn as we see what's going on in Ukraine?
Yeah, so the Western Pacific is a huge problem set for the Army. But it's obviously one that we take extremely seriously. And if there's one upside to the geography of the Pacific is that it goes both ways and that the Chinese will have to deal with that same geography going the other direction. I think the Chinese are looking at what's happening in the Ukraine right now. They have to be, right? And kind of trying to figure out, okay, you know, we just saw, you know, all of their command posts get struck in very close order. And we don't obviously want that to happen to us as well. So we have to kind of understand that they're probably going to be changing up their methodologies for how they conduct command and control in the same way that we're looking at, you know, how we're going to do that. We have to expect, I think, and plan for the fact that the Chinese are not going to look like the Russians when we encounter them, right? They're going to have learned some lessons. They're going to come to us probably with some better kit, I think, than what we're seeing on the battlefield right now in Eastern Ukraine. And it's an entirely different operating environment. That's it. I think that that C2 problem set, that command post problem set, is very challenging in the Pacific because of the distances that you're talking about. And from a land perspective, you know, we're largely reliant on line of sight comms and things of that nature. We're going to have to become a lot more comfortable dealing with, you know, alternative forms of communication, whether that's SATCOM, whether that's, you know, HF, UHF, all those type of things where, you know, we have not, you know, spent a lot of time and effort and energy, you know, kind of exploring those options for enabling our command and control. I think we're going to have to really start taking a look at that in a little bit more depth, and then figuring out how we work with our partners in the Navy, in the Marine Corps, to kind of come together. I think all of us, whether it's the Army, the Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, we all have challenges in terms of survivability of our command posts. You know, we've seen the capabilities of, you know, the Chinese in terms of their ISR, their ability to collect, and we kind of have to assume that this isn't going to be, you know, the fight that we have with China isn't going to be like the Battle of Midway, where we just lost complete, you know, track of where carrier strike groups are and things of that nature. I think we're going to know, you know, with some significant lead time, what our adversaries are doing. The question is going to be, now that they know what we know and we know what they know, how does that play out, right? You know, what survives first contact is going to be where I think the rubber is going to meet the road on that one. So we have to be prepared to, you know, absorb that first strike, wherever it comes from, and be able and effective to respond in kind, so that, you know, we don't get into, you know, the situations where now we're having to reconstitute an entire C2 structure, you know, in contact at great distance. That's a very dangerous environment for me.
I'm sorry, I dropped off because the electrical storm just took all the power out where I'm sitting. And we're getting close to the end of the hour. We told you we'd keep you for. Where can our, other than the article, where can our listeners find more information about what you're talking about, and what do you have plans to write more about it in the future, and what can we look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. So as it so happens, I'm actually transitioning out of the Army right now. So I'm leaving but I will continue to be working on command and control. I'm actually going up to Huntsville to work with the Rapid Capabilities Critical Technologies Office for the Army. But I'll stay very tied in with the C2 community going forward, both here in the local area and elsewhere. You know, I've written a couple of articles. This isn't my first article related to C2. In fact, I think one of the reasons why General Slider reached out to me was because I was kind of looking at some of these ideas with regard to training and education in a previous article. I'm going to try to continue to write. You can get in touch with me on Twitter. It's Army Joint C2 Pro, at Army Joint C2 Pro. That's my handle. So I'll occasionally post on there. And then obviously folks can reach out for Matt Errol on LinkedIn. And you know, I hang my articles there as well. But, you know, very eager, you know, I continue to try to, you know, keep in touch with the C2 community writ large. It's been very good being down here at Hurlburt because we have so many joint leaders in the C2 community flow through the schoolhouse down here at the 505th Command and Control Wing, that I really have benefited, I think, from the opportunity to interact with so many of my partners in the joint force and kind of get a truly multi-service and allied perspective on things, which, you know, I find this work very, very valuable, very rewarding, and it's one I intend to continue to support it, you know, even into retirement.
Well, Matt, we really appreciate it. It's been a great hour, real informative. I appreciate you being patient with a couple of Navy guys that's trying to figure it out. But as we've discussed, everything in this article, it doesn't just apply to the Army. This is really joint in the best sense. And I would copy, because you did mention the article, a lot of our allies, too, have developed similar habits, and hopefully their militaries are hoisting on board some of the changes they need to make in this area that we got a little bit too settled with. And I wish you the best of luck in your next position. We'll be keeping track of you and look forward to the next opportunity to talk with you about what you're working on.
All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. Enjoyed talking to you.
Yep.
And we appreciate everybody for joining us for another edition of MidRat. Just to give you a heads up, we're going to be taking a couple of weeks off as life gets kind of busy, but we're going to be back here on the 21st of May. And our guest on the 21st, coming back, one of our favorites, Claude Berube. Third novel is out. It's just got available this weekend over on Amazon, called The Philippine Pact. That's another Connor Stark novel that everybody's been waiting a few years for. And we look forward to talking to Claude about that. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy and, what the heck, good Army Day, too. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame.